But I have no chat log.
Good evening, everyone. It's Wednesday night, and we're continuing our work through Life in the Labyrinth. We're on chapter 16. We're on part two of it. This evening, I'd like to actually dedicate the class and our efforts into it to a very important friend of mine. Her name was Jody, and she passed away yesterday. A remarkable individual, highly successful businesswoman, and I've been about, 6 months ago, she's been suffering from cancer for 2 years, and about 6 months ago, she dedicated herself to just freeing herself. She said, "I want to free myself before I go." She belonged to a community in Seattle and lived in an ashram with a number of other women. And during the last few days of her trial, this is a gorgeous house. It's just beautifully kept. And there's this big meditation hall. And several days before she passed, they moved her bed down there, so she was in the meditation hall. And people would meditate two or three times a day, and then her guru would do darshan, very powerful spaces. And so she was in that space, and that's what she was working toward. And her daughter had flown up from California to be with her, and what a way to go. So a lot of good work is going on in many, many places. And we shall honor and should honor our fellow workers. And we're part of that. And this evening, we are together with our fellow workers. And we need to remember that. As far and few between as we are, when we are together with those fellow workers, embolden yourself to share yourself, because the moments are remarkably few that we have to do our work. And in a moment, we too will have passed, and the world will continue as it does. And it is our job, while we are here, to do as comprehensive a work as we are able to do with each other, for each other, and for the good of all beings everywhere. On that dedication, let's begin part two. Yes, <sir. clears throat> So, I don't know if anybody marked where we left off, but I marked place, and I marked it start, and then I followed with a question mark. Mm-hmm. So, unless anybody has something different, I'm going to start on page 202 of the new edition, and it's a paragraph that starts with, "If we understand clearly the method of prayer absolute." Do you have that,
Ivan? 179 in the older.
Oh, we've lost our picture. George, are you still there?
I am still here. We've lost the picture and actually the audio as well. I'm just refreshing my screen now.
Audio also.
Yeah, okay. I should reboot that.
Go ahead and reboot. Yeah, but go ahead and why don't you just...
Type in that they're going to reboot, Jim. Marvette is going to reboot.
I don't know if anybody still has the audio, but we're going to reboot. How many people are on there tonight, Jenna?
We have
11. Okay, there we go. So we got, we had to reboot the computer, and we might be up and running again soon.
David, I'm here.
Harry, greetings. Thank you for coming.
Yes. Okay, we've got the picture back and the audio, it sounds like.
Okay, so we're up and running, and so we're up and running again. So we're starting on page 202 of the new edition and 179, and it's the paragraph that starts with, "If we understand clearly the method of prayer absolute." Susan, are you here? Are you on the phone?
Yes, I am here.
Hi, Susan. Do you have, are you on your computer as well?
I am, but I have no chat. And my picture's frozen.
Okay.
I don't have a chat room either.
You might need to refresh or refresh your page.
I just refreshed, David, and that chat room doesn't seem to be working tonight.
Okay.
At least not now.
Okay. If there's a question, raise your hand. Okay, Molly? And Susan, let's just get it. We're up and running here now. So I'm going to continue, and we'll do what we can then. Okay.
Very good.
Clearly the method of prayer absolute, and most of us won't. We will draw our cosmic necrophilous lover more and more deeply toward ourselves, enfolding it with breathless love in the totality of our attention, taking the utmost care not to accidentally or unknowingly inflict our own life force upon it. If it is to live, it must come to life on its own initiation. Are we live? Could you hear that on the computer, George?
I had my computer silenced, but I can hear myself over the phone right now.
Okay. This particular paragraph is of great importance to me, and I'm helping to get guidance from the class on it. Okay. If we understand clearly the method of prayer absolute, we will draw our cosmic necrophilous lover more and more deeply toward ourselves, enfolding it with breathless love and the totality of our attention, making the utmost care not to accidentally or unknowingly inflict our own life force upon it. If it is to live, it must come to life on its own initiation. So here it's saying that we're enfolding it. We draw down. It's a strange thing, but we draw down grace, and we're imbued with this grace, and we enfold our beloved with that grace. But yet at the same time, there's the admonition, don't conflict your life force upon it. It must want to come alive. This makes sense to me, but it's a mystery that I need to understand more. It's important for me to understand this, because this is how I want to operate in the world. How do I come forth and, in a sense, emanate my own being? And more love is coming out of this being, and yet I don't want to inflict it upon anyone else. One of the things that occurs to me, Ivan, and everyone, is that if I am interested in inflicting it,
right?
If I have that interest, ego,
yes,
my infinite, almost infinite ego, is there. It wants to be recognized as such, and it gets into the very heart of what is prayer. Prayer is a very, very important part of our work. When we pray, prayer is not an external methodology, as been taught by every religion that I've ever known. Mostly prayer is praying to some form of a Godhead for some result. I'm praying so that my turtle won't die. Please, God, help my python come through this illness.
Petition.
Lord, help my company through this lawsuit. Oh, heaven above, I really want that new BMW. I want it so much. Please, Lord.
But what about, please, Lord, help my friend in her transition?
Even that is a petition. Even that is a call for something. You might be able to put in the effort to give help to your friend in transition. You might be able to somehow be there. And so this is a great mystery to me, how to remain in a moment of pure presence and attention where you are not disturbing the water. It's a fine line, but it has something to do with being in that moment of full presence and attention. And when I'm in that moment of presence and attention, then I just am that moment of love. And I am that moment of grace that is flowing through me. As soon as I start to use that for my personal gain, I have devolved it. That doesn't mean that there's not, the power goes away. It's what do you use it for? By their fruits they shall be known. And that's the case here.
David, it seems that we would be attracted or repelled if we were trying to decide what the absolute needed. I don't even know what I need.
I think that's a great point, Harry, is that we don't know. But what we can, I think we can, what can we know and what can we say? We can have a sense, can we have a sense of what it means to be in presence and attention? I think we can begin to purify that. The act of understanding, this act of understanding, and I mean it in this particular context, Harry, okay? This act of understanding our own presence and the purity of that of presence and attention, that's a dynamic act. You're active in that. That act of understanding is virtue itself. And this is 500 years ago, or 450 years ago, was stated by Benedictus de Spinoza. This act of,
I think we make ourselves available.
So if you, yeah, but how you make yourself available and you start to, there's a dissension of grace, and then what occurs at that point is, oh, I am able to do this. I now am this. And I think at that moment.
That's ego then.
Go ahead. You just need to, this is the, the vigilance, the great vigilance that we must impose upon ourselves. Anyway, I don't know if that's an important factor for people, but for me,
well,
it is.
Yeah, I think that what we're about to enter into this evening, David, is this entire passage we're about to read is very technical. It's filled with a lot of hints, lots of indications of techniques of structures and adjustments and map to follow, somewhat of a map to follow. You know, it's actually not very much about, not a formula, it's more of a set of operating instructions. I mean, I think there's a difference between mystery and something that we can understand or define, let's say. There's a mystery of some experience over and over again. It's very difficult to
that experience is. If you need to explain it to John, you know, this book communicated a lot of very detailed information about experiences.
No question he is, and he's pointing us in a direction. And it's us that must walk that path. The work gets harder and harder and harder. Because the level of discernment becomes so subtle. It's very subtle at this point. Nevertheless, it's possible. It's possible for that discernment to take place. Okay? Well, we made it through one whole paragraph.
Hey, and Dave, if I could throw in my two cents as well, just to keep things going. Look, at so much of human biological machine, life in the labyrinth, refers to the cultivation and development of our essential self as the progenitor or primary mover of awakening the machine. And my understanding of this essential self is that it's immaterial in the sense that it is only a vibratory sensation which is gradually awakening the human biological machine, and in that process begins to serve as a link to the absolute itself, since it's that much closer to the state of the absolute. And serves maybe as a intermediary between the absolute, our own essential self, and then the essential self as a center of gravity over the influencing of the HBM and our personality. And in that sense, we are able to engage in prayer absolute, since we're the local representative of the absolute. Christ said we are ambassadors. We're ambassadors for Christ.
Yes, so we are able to be the reflection of the absolute to the extent that we can hold that plane. And part of this whole book is already assuming that you already know how to get there.
Yep.
It assumes you already know how to get there.
Yep.
Now what are you going to do with it?
Yep.
Like Susan saying, there's a friend in transition. Can you be with that person? Can you be in that space? Not that can you be anything like a big, important person. How about just being in the space with that person? That's the work that you can do. That's big. What Susan was talking about is very, very difficult. Jumping ahead, when it talks about being in the place of prayer absolute, in this act, the absolute is seen and known. The truth, clarity, and force of the experience will leave a permanent scar across the mind and an insatiable yearning in the being. So it's a strange thing. It's like the more you do this, the more you work in this manner and imbue yourself with being in that space, the more I'm not sure it's right to say you want to be there, but there's a yearning to be there. It's like, here is how I complete myself. Ivan talks about the beloved. If you are then completed with your beloved. Okay? You're completed with it. In the act of loving from that point of view, you are completed. Prayer absolute is not prayer toward the absolute. It is the descending incantation of the absolute itself. So this is what I was trying to say about prayer. The different form of prayer than Reverend Ike says, I want to get my treasures in heaven on earth now. You know, at least he was honest about it. Mm-hmm. I like that. And all I say is, so this is a different form of prayer. You allow that invocation to occur, and by having the balls to allow it to occur and holding that energy, by being allowing yourself to hold that energy, then you're doing something there. It's jumping ahead again. In our shamanistic functioning as lightning rods. Did you have that? Do you find that, Ivan?
In upper 180?
Yeah, one, just the next two paragraphs. In our shamanistic functioning as lightning rods, we provide the electrical and topological connectivity. This is what George was getting to earlier, that we are an electrical body. We're an electrical body called the essential self. And as such, we can provide the role called, I am a lightning rod. What is, just in natural words, what is a lightning rod? Is anybody,
Beacon.
It's a beacon. It draws down, right? It draws down. It's actually kind of a protective method that when lightning hits, it's supposed to hit a lightning rod,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's like a magnet.
A magnet. You're calling it forth. So what if you're willing to be a lightning rod? How about that, Susan?
Well, then you're allowing the energy.
Yeah. To manifest.
Also to flow through you.
Yeah. I know you've been there, so.
If we allow, then our essence is in resonance with the absolute.
By definition, right?
I think.
Yeah, because we are allowing. In a couple of paragraphs, in the next page, we're going to get to with something about sacrifice. So we have here this electrical and topological connectivity, a totem of simultaneously ascending and descending dimensional forms from the lowest to the highest. And this is a little bit beyond our pay grade, you know, really, when we're talking about acting as active totems for higher dimensional beings. I don't know, is... Hawk Lady on? Yeah. You don't know what role you're going to wind up playing, and we'll get to that. We will get to the last paragraph before the end of this class, but you don't know what role you're supposed to be playing. But can you hold yourself in, let's say, an expectant, a place of expectant hospitality? I have to go back and read... maybe it's the Iliad or the Odyssey. And in there they talk, Homer's talking about this, the role of hospitality played in the ancient world. If someone comes to your door, you don't start by asking, who are you, what are your credentials? You start by offering them hospitality. And we're afraid to do that.
Well, I think the hospitality puts you in that space of allowing whatever the need is of the guest.
Yeah. And think of that as just an exercise. You and I have talked about hospitality a lot. And think of the exercise of being in the moment of hospitality for the guest.
I think that's a good image or a good analogy for what you were asking before regarding the mystery, which is to say hospitality to emanate, to push my presence and attention to lavish it on the beloved, on the dead lover, whatever. But not, what was it? Not impose.
Inflict.
Not inflict or impose. I mean, this is a form of hospitality because, I mean, it's like it's something that you do actively to extend your hospitality, but at the same time, you just said it. Like, you're not inquisitive. You're not judging the guest. You know, you're not asking for credentials. You're accepting. You're being both active and what is it called? Not passive, but
acquiescent,
like affirming and say affirming and denying, or active and passive. Somehow it's like a mixture of active and passive. Anyway, just a thought.
And I can see what you mean by that, Ivan, because you're passively waiting for the needs, and then you're actively fulfilling them.
Yes.
Yeah, you have an obligation if you're a host, if you're extending hospitality, you have an obligation, and there's actions that you must take, but you don't know ahead of time. You know, you can't prejudge, or you aren't prescient, let's say, to know what the guest is going to bring to you, you know, who that
Correct.
Guest is, which is even in David's reference, like this is exactly what happened in the Odyssey, is they extend this hospitality, and they find this man washed up on the shore, and so on and so on, and they don't know until they have some kind of tremendous athletic contest that this is the famous hero, you know, hero of the Trojan War,
Odysseus. Yeah.
They find out when he starts shooting a bow and winning all the races.
Telling
yeah.
a story
yeah.
that only he could tell.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So
that's the guest that comes to life, in a sense. So it's an image of a guest who comes to life.
So it's a way of practicing. And when we see this in Christian literature, too, we see it mentioned, but I dare say not always practiced. And, you know, hold, or you don't know who is before you. You know not who is knocking at the door. You never do.
Okay.
And we'll get to there then, too.
Would you say something about this paragraph that's
yeah.
coming up? I really took note of. In our performance of prayer absolute,
yeah. Go ahead.
We must bring ourselves into the posture, subjective mood, and cognitive position of the absolute, suggested by sculptural representations of and so on. You know, I thought this is what I was talking mm-hmm. about indications. You know, you're giving very strong clues, you know, as to how you would work yourself into this, how you would practice this prayer posture, it seems to me. There's a really unusual concept. I mean, that's like, so how do you orient,
this is
how do you assume the posture of the man on the cross?
Because this is common with virtually all the esoteric religions on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's working with iconic imagery and working with it in a dynamic form. The form that, in my opinion, quite uniquely, that E.J. Gold is presenting here, called this the man on the cross, and that the absolute is on the cross and postured in that manner, and there's only one way for that being, in a sense, to descend from it. So in the beautiful, you know, for instance, Russian iconography is quite gorgeous, or the remarkable mandalas of the Indians and the Buddhists, so on and so forth. These are powerful reminding factors. They're not just external reminding factors. They're reminding factors that if we give our attention to it in a certain manner, it helps us get to these higher levels. So it's a form of faith in those. But I say that any effort that's pure along these lines will yield that food for you. This particular food is called man on the cross. And Jan, you'll raise your hand. So it's called man on the cross. And that's this particular slant of the entree to what's called prayer absolute. The prayer absolute means this invocation of sensing the posture of the absolute in this conundrum that it is in. Okay, does that help a little bit, Ivan?
Yeah.
Does that get us there a little?
Sure.
Okay, and I want to jump ahead. Let's see. Yeah.
Can I say something first?
Yeah, please.
Well, I'm seeing that we must bring ourselves into the posture. Wouldn't that be like we must become the same vibratory?
Yes. Well put.
Of the essence.
He gets the gold star.
Well, yeah.
Well.
There's mood, objective mood, and cognitive position.
Yeah.
The absolute. It's like, actually, what you have there is the moving center, emotional center, and intellectual center right there is in that formulation.
Yeah. And do you have this book here, The Hidden Work? Do you have it, Susan?
I think I do. I can go look.
You dig it up at some point. And then Chapter 11 is entitled The Method of Prayer Absolute. And first, just in the beginning, because later you will not require the help of an external focus for your attention, seat yourself before a figure or portrait of the man on the cross. Concentrate your attention on the form, trying to see the vision of the world through the eyes of the man on the cross, exactly as he sees it from the vantage point of the cross. One day you will see it, and you'll know what it is, the vision of the man on the cross, because you'll be looking down from the top of that cross. So, yes, bang on, Susan. You find that vibratory moment, and you work with that, because that's what we have.
And it just feels like the allowing and can put you in the same vibration. I don't know, it seems tied together for me.
It is. It is. There's an interface between you holding your attention on the essential self, holding it open in a sense, focusing, as George says, on the vibratory sensation that is, holding it, at the same time then saying, okay, now that that's open, let me allow this new element in. Where else does that take me at that point? And he talks about the experienced, grizzled shaman will find no surprise in the fact that a voyager in a particularly primate frame of mind will be unable to maintain the state for more than a few breathing cycles, Susan. That should answer that in part. That if we can hold being in a non-primate frame of mind, we can stay there for a couple of counts longer. When we can't hold out any longer, we needn't worry. Another shaman, refreshed from a short vacation in one or another of the lower worlds, will probably wander nonchalantly along, just as we did, and slowly taking notice of our distress, will offer in a slow drawl, as sweat, metaphorically speaking, gushes down our macro-dimensional brow to take our place, of course. Always far too slowly, for our taste, just a hair too late. And thus, we have an example of, and I am my brother's keeper. Molly, there's a question. Susan, are you able to receive the chat?
No, I'm not getting any chat at all.
None at all.
Okay, so there is something
from
Hawk Lady.
Okay. Hawk Lady.
Yeah, Hawk Lady has a question for you, Susan. It's a statement. Share the statement. Hawk Lady says to you, instead of a gold sticker, she grants you a key, and you are able to use that key whenever you like, she says to us. And we'll remember, I'll try to remember to send you the log. I'll post the log, but I'll send you a copy of it too, Susan.
Well.
Yeah, well.
That's wonderful key.
You took it to another level, once again. And why did that happen? Because we're working together in a group tonight. It's the group. Because we're in a group together, not because of any one individual. It's the group, everybody that's in the room, everybody is part of it, and it's helping immensely. Yes. Okay. Spinhog is saying that Internet Explorer isn't working on the chat, but Firefox and Chrome are, apparently. And that's all we got on that
right.
one.
Right, so you can try to use another browser.
So
let me just comment here that I noticed that, you know, again, in regard to understanding the mystery, that, you know, EJ went from in talking about, let's say, lest you require to know, well, like, you know, how long exactly do I have to hold this posture of the man on the cross and so on. He says in the earlier paragraph that David was reading, or that I was reading, actually, he says, maintaining this in stillness and in silence as long as we can possibly tolerate it, at least to a slow count of 24, timed to a full sonorous cycle of in-breath and out-breath, corresponding to a full creation cycle regulated by the breathing, if it can be called that, and it often is, of the absolute. And then, okay, well, that sounds pretty specific, doesn't it? But then, regarding the same issue, a few paragraphs later, he says, the Voyager, and particularly primary framework, will be unable to maintain this state for more than one or two full breathing cycles, which is to say, a count of 1 or 2 billion subjective millennia or seconds, whichever seems longer. So I think it's pretty clear that EJ's, you know, I think that he wants to be sure that you don't try to make a chart, you know, a mathematical formula of how, again, how this, all of this is done in prayer absolute, that there's a mystery of
absolutely.
There's mysteries of invocation involved here.
And this is beyond, in a certain way, it's beyond our pay grade too, but it's something we begin to discover. We begin to discover how it works, and when we hold the mantle of that particular responsibility, then what does that mean? Well, different things will unfold for each of us in different manners. Okay? Good point, though.
Yeah, and again, this is, I like that, keeping in mind in the background what we were talking about last week, that in the Prayer Absolute workshop, the point was made very strongly that Prayer Absolute doesn't look a particular way.
Correct.
You know, that if I'm a flamenco dancer, Prayer Absolute looks like flamenco.
But it looks like something.
Yeah. It looks like something that I can do where I can assume that posture and mood and cognition for that beat cycle of several breaths in and out and so on. Yeah.
Continuing, as we lose our sweaty macronid dimensional grip on the absolute, a split moment before our relief shaman has taken hold, we note en passant, which in this case means on the way down, the chilling fact that very few beings are willing and able to perform this intensely impersonal sacrifice. What is that sacrifice again?
To be present for the absolute.
Okay. To invoke the absolute for however many moments that is?
Yes. I like that formulation, Susan. Does anybody else have the right answer? Jana has the right answer. Oh, somebody does. Go ahead. Spinhog says death of ego. Yes. How can you do this? Your ego will attempt to come into this space. It will want to, you know, Shanghai it from you. But if you can weave that narrow path, what is it that the one of the Buddhists, the Zen thing says? It's like a snail passing over the edge of a razor. That's how delicate this is. Can we be that delicate? The answer is yes. 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 Hang on. So Aria was saying that for the longest time, she had the idea that there was a specific way of doing prayer absolute, and now she realized maybe there's different ways for different individuals. Right? Did I get it?
And Becky, was that a way to be
in stillness and silence? And Becky is reminding us that the way to be is stillness and silence. Those are two technical terms that are very potent for us. Can you be in stillness? Okay. I'm going to have to jump ahead a bit, okay? Because I desperately think we need to get...
Yeah, there's a lot of this chapter left.
I'm going to jump ahead almost two pages here. And it gets at the top of 206 in the new version. But for that part of our work in which we act as lightning rods, you see that?
Yes, page 182 in here.
For the descent of the absolute from the cross, and then during this assumption, sweat blood more or less in our efforts to bring creation to life. We depend largely upon our ability to utilize higher emotions, which are exactly those emotions which empower us to pass easily through the heart of the labyrinth on our way to the highest macro dimensions. In a sense, our passage through the heart of the labyrinth guarantees that we are able to perform these exalted two forms of palliative macro-dimensional work. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, coming to the passage where he talks about exaltation plus R, you know, the particular mood and feeling of some of this work is a mixture, that's all.
And then jumping ahead, the key to all this is to be able to assume the posture of the absolute and then act from that viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
This requires many factors of mood, thought, sensation, perception, and reaction quite different from our customer. We're being offered some tools here that are remarkably unusual in literature, spiritual literature. So I know for a lot that it's difficult, it's heavy to be in this area, but it's fulfilling us in a certain nonverbal manner. Allow that meal to go in. It will digest properly. A blend of exaltation and horror produce the mood of the man on the cross. The balance of extremes at its most intense is what we have been both running away from and at the same time looking for. All our lives, it is the goal, knowingly or unknowingly, of every saint, living or dead. George, I'm going to ask you to help us on this next paragraph. The figure of the man on the cross is, as we can see by his representation, its representation, in three dimensions, fixed firmly in place by three nails, the affirming, the denying, and the reconciling. Father, the Son, and the unseen essential spirit, which moves freely within. And you've spoken about that often over the last couple of years. Do you want to just say anything about those three different elements again?
Yeah, it's, you know, again, I derive my understanding from Gurdjieff, who explains this in Beelzebub's Tales, that... each of us is comprised of three separate, co-equal, heterogeneous forces, which are diametrically opposite. So in one case, one of these forces is our HBM, our human biological machine and personality. The second force is our essential self. And in accordance with my understanding, the absolute is actually found in that the blending of those two forces in that third reconciling force. And for most of us, we spend our whole life with our human biological machine and personality active. Well, if we pacified it and our essential self became the active force, then we are, in a sense, able to enter into the place of the absolute and see how these three forces mix together. But I'm telling you, David, this is very deep material. All of this is very deep material. I can intuitively, I think all of us can intuitively feel what's going on here, but to personally acquire the experience is, you know, the product of many years of effort.
It is, and everybody that's here in its own way and form has had many years of effort. But this, as George is saying, this is very, it's different. We read it and we can intuitively sense that it's something that's important and that we know and that we want to go toward. But as he's also telling us, this is just simply really, we haven't all experienced this yet. Like, for instance, each nail is unreal in the sense that they fixate the form only because the bearer of the cross holds them in place, the first by self-initiated, self-directed attention. Second, by intentionally invoked self-presence. The third, by sheer will. So these are things, these are the kinds of practices that are involved here. The practice doesn't happen when you read the book. It happens when you work on what does it mean to intentionally invoke self-presence. Work with that and be in that space of self-presence. That's the work you can do. That's something we can do. Maybe for one inch of 1 second, but it's the work to do that. All this can serve to remind us of our deep yearning for the beloved, the other face of the absolute, of which we only capture fleeting glimpses as it skirts around corners, disappearing into the darkness, a glance of the tip of a robe, a heel, a subtle lingering perfume, all of which hint at the incomplete vision we see, the all-embracing beauty for which we restlessly search. We are left wondering whether the beloved is something we have invented to fill our dreams and torment our souls. But in spite of this, our disillusionment and disenchantment, and perhaps because we have dispelled the illusions and enchantments that have bound us, we continue undaunted in our quest.
Yeah, there's a great suggestion there of, did we lose our audio? Or okay, Janet is lost.
Okay.
There's a great suggestion there of the archetypes that are in so many fairy tales. This is when the Sleeping Beauty is awakened, or you know how the princess is rescued by the prince, and so on. All the enchantments are bypassed or unraveled. You know, the enchanted forest and the spells of sleep and everything else has to be overcome. Anyway, in the quest, in the fairy tales.
But that's what we're living. We're talking about living in that manner. Actually putting this to practice in your life every day, these principles of self-directed attention, self-initiated, intentionally self-invoked self-presence, and then sheer will. All the time when you're doing that, walking through the day, let it become part of your life. Like George is saying, when the balance starts to tip toward the essential self, the life starts to change. And it has started to change. But now, own it more. Own it. Don't sit with, oh gosh, I'll never be able to, I can't, I'm not, I'm the, that. That's ego too. That's ego too. Our dogged perseverance may open up new avenues of pursuit, although If we depend on bull doggish stubbornness, the outcome is dodgy at best. So it's not just that. You do have to use your higher intuition and to help guide you. The best approach is to apply the trained and disciplined attention as an instrument, which can enable us to approach the beloved through discipline. We might find ourselves slowly moving from a position of dissatisfaction, distance, and incompleteness to a position of proximity, more than sufficient for our life-giving purposes to the beloved. Beautifully put, huh?
Yeah, but also, let's say if you want to finish the chapter, what I took out of this closing of this chapter, there's a marvelous image that E.J. brings in here, and this is coming over about a page later than where you just were.
Yeah.
It's, what is it, 185 in this edition, when he reaches on the dimensional level where this can take place, is bringing the creation to life. Being is not fractioned, and creation can be viewed as a dead lover. At this level, even above the highest macro dimensions, no labyrinth exists. This is I was really shocked. I know I've read this before, but I didn't remember this at all. The universe is just an empty sack. Its internal complexity increases only as the dimensional levels decrease by an elaborate fractioning process, et cetera, et cetera. This goes on for paragraphs about this fractioning and, you know, the like musical chords and the vibrational fractioning and so on. But this is a great, really remarkable view that he's giving here, which is to say this viewpoint that we could hope to hold maybe for only so many breaths or so many instants or, you know,
yeah.
for what might seem like eternal instants and so on. But this is a view where not only am I alone, in other words, there's a unity of everything, but also all of this other, all these other ideas that this whole book is filled with about the labyrinth and the fractioning and the macro dimensions and the moving sideways and moving up and down the totem and moving here and moving there, it's all sort of subsumed. It becomes very simple at this level here that everything is a unity. There's only the awareness of the man on the cross and this creation that's I or the man on the cross I'm attached to that needs to be enlivened.
Harry, are you still on the phone?
I am.
So what are you going to do tomorrow?
What am I going to do tomorrow?
Yeah.
I don't know. What did you have in mind?
When you go do it tomorrow, do you... think you can apply some of these principles while you're doing that?
Oh, I know I try daily, and usually I come away with an insight or two that prolongs the moment.
So I try daily, I continue. I don't particularly care for the word try, but he applies himself to this daily, and once or twice during the day, there's something that occurs where he can sense the vibratory force that we're talking about and prolong it. It's like you suddenly realize this is it. And how do I recognize it? By the vibratory sensation that George is talking about so often. That's the vibratory sensation. And suddenly you're in this space. It could be at the donut shop. Wherever, the post office, wherever you happen to be.
Yeah,
even Walmart.
Walmart, oh no. That posture,
oh, even at Walmart.
That
in line at Walmart, oh yes.
Yeah?
It was a great experience.
Yeah, posture, mood, and cognition.
Posture, mood, and cognition.
They're not, the content is whatever.
As it says in the Bible, watch always. And another place it says, pray always, and we've talked about the way of the pilgrim and the Jesus prayer, where it gradually becomes part of you. This will become part of you too, and you can find that you can find your way to that space if you have a little bit of self-directed attention, some invoked presence, and sheer will. But it has to be on your dance card when you get to that position. So tomorrow, when you're out at Walmart and in line, pose yourself into that position, because at some point you're going to come to the cashier, and you don't know the cashier, who they are, what they've been doing that day, or what moment you are to share with that individual. There may be a moment that gets shared with that individual that they will then recall, and they'll take home, and their 8-year-old son or daughter suddenly gets the gift that that child needed. And I don't mean a physical something or another, but a vibratory sensation. It takes practice and selflessness, as Susan said earlier. In a typical scenario, the creation slowly comes to life, blossoms in sheer, breathtaking beauty, a vision of rapturous delight, dancing in brilliant splendor. Then we are forced to watch helplessly as it withers, crumples, and collapses almost instantly into a dry, wrinkled, and horribly shriveled, petrified gray lump, like a water-drenched Disney witch or a bargain facelift gone bad. If there's a moral to all this, it's probably something like, never assume you know who you're with just because they look like someone you know and were with a moment ago and who hasn't left the room since you last looked. This is practicing being in the space of wonder. And if you can hold yourself in the space of wonder one moment longer, even longer than this moment right now. In 10 minutes, we're going to be done. The computer's going to go off. You're going to jump on Facebook, or you're going to go watch the game, or you're going to go do whatever you do. Can you hold the sense of wonder into that space too? It's not just now. This is a reminding factor. The image of the man on the cross is a reminding factor. Carry that forth with you as you go forward. Ivan, what's the last?
I'm going to read the verse here.
Yeah.
Any gateways that lead to the heart of the life have no human connotations. The price of absolute intimacy is to be alone.
Or is it all one?
All one. Alone or all one. Yeah. Maybe both.
Thank you, everyone. That was a great class.
Yeah. We have a little bit of... the next chapter... There are a number of chapters in his books that are really experiences that individuals have, and I believe this one is that. I think they're important to read, but I'm not sure if it's something that we want to cover in the class. What are your thoughts, anybody? And then the epilogue comes, the force of attention.
I think that to see how other people and other experiences can show, give us just different way to look at it.
Okay.
Well, how about if we read both of those, the chapter 17 and the epilogue for next week? I think that'll make it.
Read them both. Read them both, and we'll blend them. Because that's like the end of the end, okay? And we'll bring that together. I'm not sure where we'll wind up after all of that, and we may be taking a bit of a break. But we'll have a class next week for sure, and we'll see how it unfolds after that. So come with some ideas on that as well. And we'll see if there are other books that people want to do, or should we take a break, or what. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, that's all for this particular class on Life in the Labyrinth, Chapter 16, Part 2. And I think we got a pretty good workout tonight, Ivan.
Yeah, we covered some of it.
Thank you for everybody for coming, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Ivan. Good work tonight.